Good evening and welcome. Welcome to the Bard's Grove. Hello, this is Kat, your hostess. Tonight, Lantern's off visiting his family in the Rocky Mountains. So tonight I am here at the Bard's Grove by myself. And I don't know if anyone would like to call in and talk, but if you do, the number is 909-265-9104. That's 909-265-9104. So tonight, wow, the night before the night, the last night of 2011. The end of a long and hard and interesting year. And next year bodes well for even more interesting things to happen. So tonight, as I contemplated what story I'd like to tell, I was thinking about how do we change our world and bring it back to life? Because the land itself is dying in many places, and many species are dying, and people are dying, and the air is getting polluted, and the water is getting polluted. So in a way, we have a very sick world we've created. And so there is the idea of the wasteland that's on one level, but this is a different story. This is about sort of a magical death and a magical rebirth. It's part of the story of Rhiannon. Now, Rhiannon is a Welsh goddess. She is a horse goddess as well as a great queen and a muse. And one of the wonderful things about her is she's a fairy lady who decided to marry a mortal. So she brings the other world, the magical world, the fairy world, into our world, our human mortal world. And at a certain point, that magical fairy world takes our world and takes it away, just makes it disappear. And so it's really this balance between how to balance these both worlds and bring real fertility into life. So this is the story of Rhiannon. It comes from the book by Myra Caldicott, Women in Celtic Myth. You mean to tell me he lay in the bed with you night after night for a whole year and did not once make love to you? Rhiannon asked. Arwen's wife laughed. I know. That a man's sense of honor should be stronger than his desires does seem impossible, but I assure you that's how it was. My lord said when he returned that he had never known a friend so trustworthy or a human so honorable. But tell me, Rhiannon persisted, did you suspect nothing? She was fascinated by the story her friend had told her. It seemed a young man named Powell had allowed his own hunting hounds to have the kill, which had been brought down by the magical hounds of Arwen, the king of Annoon. Instead of punishing him for the trespass, Lord Arwen had agreed that he could earn his forgiveness and his friendship by undertaking a difficult task. Powell had been eager to comply, and without demur had exchanged place and form with Arwen for a year and a day. Arwen had told no one, not even his beloved wife, so that when Powell came to bed with her at night, she had thought he was her own husband, Arwen. At first, she said, when he turned his back to me, I let him lie. But when night after night the same thing happened, I began to worry. I did everything in my power to arouse him. Many a time I could feel that he was more than ready. But then he would leap up and walk about and sometimes even leave the chamber rather than take me in his arms. There was a time when I became so depressed I wondered what I had done to offend my husband. But in the day he was so affectionate that I could not believe he did not love me. Eventually I decided it was his feud with Havgan which was preying on his mind. And as soon as that was settled, his manhood would return to him. And so I let him be. And I was proved to be right. At the end of the year, the two met at the ford. Arwen, or he who I thought was Arwen, struck the one blow necessary to destroy his enemy. A night later, he returned to me with all his old passion, and we made love as though we had been parted for a year and a day. As indeed you had, laughed Rhiannon. I know that now, but I didn't know that then. So what was he like, this human? And now it was her friend's turn to laugh. Well, he was exactly like Arwen. I suspected nothing. You can be sure I berated my lord prettily, thoroughly, for the trick he played on me. What did he say to that? He said the test for Powell would not have been complete had I known. Nevertheless, he was amazed that Powell had not succumbed to me. What with ruling the kingdom so admirably, defeating his enemy, and respecting his bed, Powell really earned Arwen's respect and friendship. And Rihanna's eyes shone. What kind of human this must be who could have done all that? Have you no curiosity to go and see what he looks like in his own shape? She asked. Arwen's wife laughed. In human shape? In that clumsy, awkward form? Ugh, I am only too thankful not to see him as he really is. Well, I would like to know what he really looks like if I had spent a year in bed with him, said Rhiannon. Humans are best left all alone. They are inferior beings. Rihanna protested, but Arwen respects him as an equal now. Not as an equal. Well, as a friend at least, and friendship knows no inequality. Rhiannon, for me, he never existed. Why should I be curious? I love Arwen. There's no one else for me. There never will be. Rihanna sighed. She would like to know what the human looked like. She would like to know what it would feel like to lie in bed with him. She even wondered if he would be able to resist her as easily as he had resisted her friend. But she kept quiet now because she could see Arwen's wife was beginning to get annoyed with her. She kept quiet. But from this time on, she nursed a secret longing to see Powell. She was determined that somehow she would bring this about. Now, Rihanna was the daughter of Hedvig Hen and had lived all her life with her father in the shining realms of Enun. There, until this time, she had everything she could possibly wish for. But now she began to be restless and dream about a world she had never seen, the world of the humans, a world they talked about as the dim world, the world of sorrow and strife and shadow. One day she conceived a plan. She dressed in her finest golden robes, and riding on a snow-white horse, she set off for the borderland between the worlds. She was in luck. At Beltane, Powell and his companions had climbed the mound of Arbarth, where the two worlds are at their closest. Gazing out across the landscape, they saw Rhiannon, a beautiful woman dressed all in gold, riding a white horse. Powell, at once curious to know who she was, sent one of his companions after her to find out. The woman wasn't riding very fast, and the man expected to catch up with her in no time at all. To his surprise, though he galloped and she did not increase her pace, he found he was no nearer to her at the end than he was at the beginning. So he returned to Powell and reported that he had failed. Powell laughed and teased him for his poor horsemanship. The next day, Powell and his companions returned to the mound and again saw the woman riding. Powell dispatched a different man to find out who she was and began to be annoyed when the second rider returned with the same excuse that he had ridden as hard as he could and yet still could not catch up with the lady. Powell began to suspect that there was some enchantment at work. And on the third day, when the same rider appeared, he set off after her himself on his fastest horse. Everything happened as before. It appeared as though she was not riding very fast, and yet, no matter how hard he drove his own steed, he could not catch up with her. At last, exhausted and frustrating, he called out to her, "Lady, for the sake of the man you love, stop for me." "So I will gladly," she said, stopping at once. "And you would have been kinder to your horse if you had spoken those words earlier." Then Rhiannon saw the man she loved before her, beads of sweat on his forehead from the hard riding, eyes as green-blue as the ocean, hair as brown as hazelnuts. And Powell saw before him the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, so beautiful indeed that he doubted she was mortal. "Lady, what is your errand? For I have seen no one like you before in any of my lands. Are you a messenger from my friend Arwen?" "No," she said, "I am on an errand of my own." What errand may that be? He asked. To find the man I love best. And have you found him? He whispered. Yes, she said quietly. Then there was a long silence between them, Powell not daring to hope she meant what he thought she meant. If I am that man, he said, then Powell, Lord of Dyfed, is the happiest man alive. You are that man. And Rhiannon, daughter of Hevet Hen, is the happiest woman in the two worlds. Then Rhiannon told Powell that if he did not take her as wife, she would be married to a man she did not love. And Powell promised that he would not let that happen. They spoke for a while and arranged that Powell would come to her father's kingdom in a year and a day and claim her as his bride. When he returned to his companions, the prince was silent and thoughtful, but told no one what had transpired. Rhiannon returned to her realm and set about the long and delicate process of persuading her father that she was going to marry Powell instead of Gwal. It was not easy, but at last all was arranged and the marriage feast was set. Powell arrived with his companions and was greeted joyfully. He sat in the place of honor between Heveth and Rhiannon. The musicians plucked their harps, the minstrels sang, the bards intoned their long and heroic verses. Suddenly a tall, auburn-haired youth entered the hall and stood before Powell. Powell at once invited him to sit down and join the feast, but the youth refused, saying he had come to make a request rather than sup with him. Powell, by this time, was so flushed with wine and the pleasures of the day, he was prepared to grant anyone anything. Ask, he said grandly. Whatever it is, if it is within my power, I will grant it. The youth smiled, and Rhiannon threw up her hands in horror. She had been pulling on Powell's sleeve to try to attract his attention since the young man had entered the hall, but Powell had been too drunk to take any notice. Now she rounded on him angrily. Why did you say that? She cried. I've never heard anything so foolish. He has given his word in front of all these nobles, the youth said quickly. He has to abide by it. What is your request? Powell asked, somewhat taken aback by Rhiannon's anger. You are to marry the woman I love, said the youth. It is to ask for her and for this marriage feast that I have come. Powell looked at Rhiannon, shocked. Shocked indeed. You had better say no more, she said sharply. You've done enough mischief. This is the man I wanted to avoid. This is Gwal, son of Clud. You have given your word. Now you have to give me to him. Never, muttered Powell. But he was troubled, for he knew he would be dishonored if he broke his word. There is only one way out of it, Rhiannon whispered. I have a plan, and if you will do as I say, I will never belong to Gwal, but only to you. She told Gwal haughtily that he couldn't have this feast as his wedding feast because she had already given it to the companions of the Lord of Dyfed. She reminded him that it was not in Powell's power to give, as it was she and her father who had provided it. She told him that a similar one would be prepared for him when he returned to wed her in a year and a day. Gwal rode off with his companions and Powell with his. In his hand, Powell had a small leather bag that Rhiannon had told him to guard carefully and to bring back at the appointed time. She had instructed him in how it was to be used and made him promise to follow her instructions exactly. On the day that it had been arranged, Powell and his 99 men arrived early, and they hid in the orchard where Heveth's court, above Heveth's court, as Rhiannon had instructed them. Well, Gwal arrived with his men in all their finery ready for the wedding feast. The young bridegroom took his place at the head of the table between Heveth and Rhiannon in great good humor. The old man greeted him warmly. He was not sorry that his daughter had been tricked into marrying the man he had chosen for her. He was not sorry that Powell had shown himself to be so foolish the year before. You see, he had warned Rhiannon about humans, and she had seen for herself. There was only one thing that marred his enjoyment of the feast, and that was the way Rhiannon was treating Gwal. She greeted him with apparent enthusiasm and was smiling and talking as though there were nothing in the world that she wanted more to be wed than to be wed to him this night. But there was something in the brittleness of her smile, the slightly mocking ambivalence of her remarks, that worried her father. He had the feeling that everything was not as it seemed, and that she was plotting something. When the feasting and carousing was at its height, a ragged beggar came to the door, and because no one was barred from the celebration, he was allowed to enter in. He stood before Gwal as once Gwal had stood before Powell and craved a boon. Gwal at once generously promised to grant it if it was reasonable. "Indeed, it is reasonable, my lord," said the beggar, "for all I ask is that you fill this little bag here with food." Gwal smiled at the slightness of the request and instantly commanded that the man's bag be filled. Heveth looked across at Rhiannon when this was being done and was uneasy to notice that her eyes were shining and she was having difficulty suppressing laughter. The servants soon found that no matter how much food they stuffed in that bag, it seemed never to be full. At first, Gwal laughed at the difficulties they were having and then became annoyed. "Man, will your bag never be full?" he demanded. "It will only be full, my lord," said the ragged man, "when a nobleman, rich in land and possessions, steps into the bag and presses the food down with both his feet, saying as he does so, 'There is enough inside.'" "My lord," said Rhiannon quickly to Gwal, "do it, or there will be no food left for our guests." "Gladly," said Gwal, and he leapt up lightly to step into the bag. No sooner had he done that than the ragged man pulled the drawstring tightly over his head and imprisoned him in the bag. Then Powell triumphantly threw off his tattered garments and stood before the assembled throng with a horn to his lips. Before Gwal's men, somewhat the worse for drink, had fully grasped what had happened, the great doors swung open and Powell's men, fully armed and sober, sprang into the hall. "Now I will bargain the freedom of Gwal against the Lady Rhiannon," cried Powell. But his men, in high spirits at the turn of events, began to sport with the bag and kick it about the hall. "Daughter, what have you done?" Heveth whispered to Rhiannon, shocked. But she was standing, reaching her arms out to Powell and oblivious of all else. Helplessly, Gwal's men watched as their lord was kicked and battered in the bag. At last, Gwal cried out that such a death was no death for a nobleman. "He is right," said Heveth angrily to Rhiannon. "Nah, such is no proper death for him. Last year you saw that humans were foolish, and now you see that they are wantonly cruel. Do you still want to live among them?" She didn't reply, but Heveth could see by her expression that she had not intended the trick to take the turn it had. Powell called a halt to the savage game and moved to release Gwal from the bag. "One moment," Rhiannon said quickly. "Before that is done, we must have assurances he will make no more claims and seek no revenge, and that he will give the presents our guests are entitled to on your behalf." Gwal agreed to everything and was released, bleeding and with many broken bones. Heveth and Rhiannon watched him go, carried away by his men, and wondered if, in spite of the assurances, they would not one day have to pay dearly for the uncalled savagery of Powell's men. That night, Rhiannon's thoughts were not on human foolishness and cruelty, but on the pleasures of making love at last with the man of her choice. At the end of the long protracted festivities, it was time for Powell to return to his old land. Heveth suggested Powell should go on alone and that Rhiannon would follow later. "Dear father," Rhiannon said, "when are you going to give up this attempt to part us? You can see how it is with us. Accept it." Heveth said, "You were ever headstrong, so be it. But the time will come when you will know that I have been trying to save what I've been trying to save you from." He turned to Powell. Take care of her, human. She is more precious than all the gold and silver in your world. I will take care of her, my lord, said Powell soberly, for she is more precious to me than the world itself. Rhiannon went with Powell to Dyfed, and there at Arbeth a feast had been laid out to greet the new bride. Rhiannon was surprised that the singing was almost as sweet as in her own realm. Powell introduced her proudly to his people. She generously gave gifts to all who came, and no one went away with but a word or two to say about her beauty and her graciousness. But later, when they were at their own hearths, they wondered that their prince had chosen an alien princess from Annoon rather than a wife from one of the neighboring kingdoms. No good will come of it, they said. Their ways are not our ways. For 2 years, things seemed to go very well. Neither Powell nor Rhiannon, locked as they were in their private idol, noticed that some of the more pompous members of the court were annoyed that Rhiannon sometimes seemed to be laughing at them. Neither Powell nor Rhiannon noticed that sometimes Rhiannon's impatience with the slow and cumbersome way things were done in this world compared to the way they were done in hers annoyed some of the courtiers and their wives. In the third year, a deputation came to Powell and pointed out that Rhiannon had not yet shown any signs of bearing a child, and they strongly advised that their prince put her aside and take to wife a more likely candidate who would bear him children. Of course, Powell refused, but he said in answer to their persistence that if no child was forthcoming in another year, he might possibly consider what they had suggested. Before the following year had run its course, Rhiannon had given birth to a son. That night, after the exertions of labor, the sleeping mother and child were put in the care of 6 women. One by one, the women who were supposed to be on watch fell asleep, and when they awoke in the morning, they found to their horror that the infant had disappeared. Rhiannon herself was still peacefully asleep and unaware of this. The women anxiously considered as to what was to be done, for they knew they would be blamed. And one came up with a grisly plan to escape punishment and easily persuaded the others to do it. They seized the newly born pups of a deerhound, slaughtered them, and smeared the blood all over Rhiannon and themselves, leaving the remnants of the pup around so that they looked like they were the dismembered pieces of the baby. When Rhiannon awoke refreshed and looking for her baby, they told her that they had fought to save its life, but that she, being from the other world, had proved too strong for them. All 6 women swore that they had witnessed her ripping her child to pieces. Distraught as she was at the loss of her child, Rhiannon tried to plead with them to tell the truth, promising that whatever had happened, they would not be punished. But now the house was roused and the terrible news spread like wildfire. The 6 women protested so loudly and swore the truth of what they said with such formidable oaths that the people found it easier to believe their 6 voices than the single protestation of a woman who was from an alien world and had never really fit into theirs. Angry people gathered outside Powell's castle and shouted for Rhiannon's death. She heard them chanting as she lay in bed, weeping, weeping for her lost child. So adamant were the women and so skillfully had they wove their story that Rhiannon herself began to wonder if there was not some truth in it. Who knew what terrible things she might have done in her sleep? She often felt torn between the 2 worlds, and so perhaps some fell being had taken over her mind when she was hovering between neither one of them and made her harm her own child. Powell listened to the story of the woman with a white face. He couldn't believe his beautiful Rhiannon had done what they said. But all evidence seemed to point against her. Besides, here he was influenced by his companions. She was not of their world, and who knew what other world people were capable of? She had been extremely angry when she found out his companions had suggested she should be put aside if she did not produce a child. Perhaps she had produced the child, then killed it to spite them. Only men could come up with ideas like that. Well, anyway, everyone demanded her death, but Powell pulled himself together enough at least to refuse to do this. He would not put Rhiannon to death, but he agreed that she should be punished. Rhiannon lost her place at his side and was doomed to live in disgrace at the gate for 7 years, there to confess her crime to every traveler who came by, and in penance ask them to allow her to carry them on her back into the presence of her lord. At this time, it was hard to know who suffered more, Powell or Rhiannon. You see, at first, loutish people spat at her and sneered, but gradually the sorrowful dignity of the queen softened every heart. Many a time Rhiannon thought of her ancient home in the shining land of Annoon and longed for the life she had led there. She remembered her father's parting words, but knew that even he would not derive satisfaction from the way his prophecy had come true. She thought of going home, but her love for Powell was not dead, and her fear that she had done what she was accused of still haunted her. Now there was a nobleman named Tiernan, who lived some way from Powell's castle, and had a mare of which he was inordinately proud. Every May Eve she foaled, but every time the foal had disappeared by morning. This particular year, Tiernan determined to solve the mystery and lay in wait, hidden in the stable all night. Suddenly, a horrible claw appeared in the window, seized the colt, and started to drag it away. Furiously, Tiernan hacked at the claw with his sword and managed to cut it right off. The claw and the foal fell within the stable. Outside, he heard a terrible scream and rushed out to see what manner of beast might have such a claw. In the darkness, he could see nothing, but he could hear it crashing away in the undergrowth. He hurried back to the stable to see how the foal was faring, and at the door almost stumbled over a bundle. When he looked more closely, he saw it was a small boy covered in blood and mucus and wrapped in a silk mantle. Tiernan at once took the child to his wife, and they agreed to rear it as their own. They called him Gweary Goldenhair, and were as astonished at how quickly he grew. In 1 year, he was as sturdy as a 3-year-old. They gave him the colt that they had rescued on the same night they found him. One day, Tiernan heard the sad tale of Rhiannon and how she was in disgrace and what had occurred to put her there. He listened attentively and began to think about Gwyr. He and his wife looked at the boy closely, and it seemed to them that there was no doubt he resembled Prince Powell. They agreed that it would be wrong for them to keep the lad any longer, as much as they loved him. They sat him upon his horse, and Tiernan and 3 companions rode with him to the court of Powell. There they found Rhiannon at the gate sadly telling her tale and offering to carry them to the castle. They spoke gently to her and led her into the presence of Powell. There they explained how they had found the boy. Rhiannon stared at the child and felt all the sorrows she had suffered lifting off of her. There was no doubt in her heart that this was the son of Powell and herself, nor was there any doubt in the heart of anyone else. Then there were tears of rejoicing and pleas for forgiveness, and the child was proudly installed as prince between his father and his mother. He was given the name Pryderi, and he swore to honor his foster mother and father as much as his own mother and father to the end of his days. Rhiannon's golden youth was gone. She was thinner than she had been, and her eyes no longer shone with humor and mischief. But she was back where she wanted to be, and her son was at her side. Powell couldn't do enough for them to make up for what they had been through. When Powell came to die, an old man, he was an old man, but Rhianna was still a woman in her prime. She sat beside his grave and mourned, thinking back over the years. She had loved him in spite of everything he had done, the foolishness of his promise to Gwal, his tardiness in checking his followers when they were humiliating and tormenting a helpless victim, and above all, his blindness in not seeing her innocence in the matter of their son. He had been a hero to his people, a friend to the king of Annoon, a mighty warrior, a noble prince, a handsome and loving man. But he had been human, and her father had warned her about humans. Rhiannon picked up a handful of loose earth from his grave mound and sifted it thoughtfully through her fingers. This earth, this strange, solid earth that humans clung to and fought over as though it were the only reality they had. Powell had been wiser than that. He'd reached after other things, albeit in the wrong way. In his youth, Powell had tried to steal the stag from the magical kill of Arun. He had tried to seize something that belonged to the supernatural realms without being granted that right. And for this, he had been put to a long and difficult trial, from which, Rhiannon thought with satisfaction, he had emerged with flying colors. She smiled, remembering her conversation with Arun's wife and her own youthful curiosity that had started the whole long chain of events. It is true that she had shown herself first to him and deliberately enticed him into her realm. But he had told her later that he and his companions were on the mound of Arberth that day, knowing that strange wonders were sometimes seen there and wanting themselves to witness such a wonder. It was only because he was already seeking the supernatural realms that she was able to appear to him at all. His rashness at the first wedding feast had shown he was not yet ready for her, and so he had to wait until he was. His second attempt was more successful. That his men behaved as they did was the only flaw. As their leader, Powell was responsible for not having taught them the true nature of honor. For this, he should have had to wait another year. Her father had tried to insist on this, but she couldn't wait and had taken him, flaws and all, because she loved him. And here she was now without him, marooned in neither one world nor the other. She couldn't leave her son, Bryderi, anchored as he was by his human blood to this world. Over the years, Rhiannon and her son, Prey, ruled Powell's cantrabs well. She kept a shrewd control at home while he campaigned and added to his lands. But when he took a wife, Kigva, daughter of Gwyn the Splendid, Paraprydary began to think that it would be best if his mother had a life of her own to lead so that his own wife could take her rightful place at his side in court matters. Prydary thought about Manawithian, one of the sons of Lear, the brother to Bran the Blessed, who had been killed in Ireland fighting for their sister Branwen. Manawithan was a man Prydary greatly respected and one who had his origins in the supernatural realms, just as Rhiannon had. As Bran's brother, he should have inherited his place as High King of the Isle of the Mighty on the death of Bran's son, but this place had been usurped by Caswallon, son of Beli. Prydary and others had offered him help to regain his lost lands, but Manawathan was not interested. He had had enough of war and killing and wanted to settle down in peace. Prydary suggested he should come to meet his mother. He spoke of her beauty, of her wisdom, of her intelligent conversation. He suggested that if Manawathan wanted her, they should marry and rule over 7 provinces of Prydary's land. If later he wanted territory of his own, Prydary would help him get it. Manawathan agreed at least to meet the lady, and Prydary took him home with Kigva and Rhiannon had prepared a magnificent feast of welcome. At the high table, Manawathan was placed next to Rhiannon. Now, Rhiannon didn't have even an inkling of what was on her son's mind as she talked to the stranger, who had a wise and gentle face. She liked him at once and found it easy to converse with him. They covered matters ranging from the passing of the seasons in this world to the timeless ideals of the shining realm of Anun. In every matter, they found the comfort of common ground. Late in the evening, Prydary leaned across to Manawathan and asked if he had decided to accept the offer or not. "What offer?" Rhiannon asked. Prydary told her that he had suggested, and Rhiannon was angry. "Was I not to be consulted on this?" "My lady," said Manawathan at once, "we did not tell you before only because we wanted to save you embarrassment. If you had known what we had in mind, you might have been wary of me, and we would never have conversed as freely as we have done. Rhiannon looked at him. She saw a handsome, mature man, one who understood her very well, one who carried the wisdom of her own shining realms with him, one whom she already liked more than any man she had seen since Powell's death. It was true there was none of the racing of the heart she had experienced with Powell, but racing of the heart is not always the criterion for a real and abiding love. "Well, what have you decided?" she asked Manawathan. He smiled at her. "Lady, if you will have me, I would be honored to be your husband." Rhiannon was silent for a moment or two longer, just enough to cause Manawathan and Prideri some anxiety. And then she too smiled. Prideri breathed a sigh of relief. Like his father before him, he tended to rush into things without proper consideration. And for a moment, he thought he had spoiled a beautiful plan. "My lord," Rhianna said, "my son Prideri had a good idea for once. I wouldn't want to ruin it for him." Manawathan laughed. "Lady, we will do well together." "Aye," she said, "I think we will." And so it was that Rhiannon entered into a new marriage and a new life. There followed some very good years. Rhiannon, Manawathan, Kigva, and Prideri were the greatest of friends, and the four spent a great deal of time together in pleasant and satisfying pursuits. One evening, the four companions were at Arbroath enjoying a feast when they felt the urge to climb the mysterious mound from which Powell had first spied Rhiannon. There was something of nostalgia in Rhiannon's decision to visit the place, and something of curiosity in Prideri's. It was summer, and the sun had not yet set. The land lay under its golden light, and they stood on the top of the hill and admired the neat pattern of the cultivated fields, the little plumes of smoke from the homesteads, the herds of cattle quietly grazing. From this height, they could see their own castle with the tiny figures of men and women, dogs and geese passing in and out. But suddenly they heard thunder and looked up at the sky, puzzled that such a sound should come from such a clear sky. When they looked down again, they saw that a thick mist was creeping over the land, and they were soon engulfed in it themselves. Kigva held Prideri's hand tightly and whispered that she wanted to go back to the castle. There was a strange eeriness about this mound that she had always hated. "That we will, my love," promised Prideri, "as soon as the mists lift a little and we can see our way." But the mist did not lift, and Rhiannon advised them all to keep close together and hold fast to one another, for she sensed that this was no ordinary evening mist rolling in from the sea. In fact, she found herself strangely excited, half wanting to slide back into the magical world of her youth, half dreading to part with the happiness she had now found in the land of Dyfed. When the mist finally disappeared, she was a little disappointed, but also a little relieved to see that they were not in Annoon. The land of Dyfed still lay at their feet, but Manawathan pulled his arms around Rhianna's waist, and Kigva clung even tighter to Prideri's arm, because, you see, the landscape was totally changed. There were no cultivated fields, just wild forest and hills as they had been in ancient times. There were no herds, no homesteads, no plumes of smoke. The castle was no more than a ring mound with a few charred remnants of wooden huts. No man, woman, or child, no dog, goose, or horse moved on the face of the earth. They were totally alone. Well, they were so shocked they said nothing to each other, but each hurried silently down the mound towards the place where their castle had been, still hoping that when they were off the magical mound, it would be as it had been before. But it was not. The desolation was complete in every direction. The castle was as they had seen it from above. There were no signs of their occupation of it. All their clothes, jewels, and fine furniture were gone. All their friends and companions lost. Night was coming on and they were afraid. That first night they huddled in the shell of the ancient buildings. They set a fire against the cold and slept close together, hoping that in the morning all would be back to normal. But in the morning they were no better off. Day after day passed, and they remained in this strange, deserted land. To eat, they had to hunt and scratch about for roots and berries like primitive people. Each morning they woke hoping to find a change. Each morning they were disappointed. At last they accepted the fact that their own country was somehow lost to them, and they decided to leave the area and travel east, hoping that some other parts of the world had been left untouched by the enchantment. For an enchantment it was. They soon found a place where there were people and farms and villages such as they had once known. They were in a place called Hereford in England, where they were not known and where they had no trappings of power and privilege. They had to start as strangers in a strange land and find work as best they could. They chose as their profession the making of saddles, and under Manawathan's expert guidance soon earned such a reputation for the beauty and comfort of the saddles they made that all the other saddle makers in the district became jealous and plotted to murder them. When this came to their notice, Manawathan at once suggested they leave the area and try their luck someplace else. Prideri wanted to stay and fight, but he was dissuaded. In the next town, they tried their hand at shield making, and again their work was so skillful that the other shield makers grew jealous and threatened to run them out of town. Prideri was furious and again wanted to draw his sword. But once again, Manawathan prevailed upon him that the best policy was to leave peaceably and start again. Grumbling, Prideri followed the others to another town. Once again, they settled down, and this time they became shoemakers. Well, this too earned them the enmity of the local shoemakers. And so even Manawathan agreed to give it up trying, and sadly, they made their way back to their beloved Dyfed. And so they hunted and gathered berries as before. One day their hunting dogs entered a copse and then rushed back to the men with trembling with terror. Astonished, Manawathan and Prideri looked to see what the trouble was and were almost run down by a huge, shining white boar that broke cover and went storming off down the valley. Well, the dogs pursued it and the men pursued the dogs. Before long, they were brought up short before the high walls of a large building, and they stood amazed, for no such building had been seen in Dyfed since the enchantment began. Manawathan put his hand on Prideri's arm to stop him from rushing headlong after the boar and his hounds. "Be careful. This building was not here before. This could also be enchantment." Prideri was impatient, though. "I can't lose my hounds. I must go and see what's happening." And he shook off Manawathan's hold and followed the hounds and the boar into the building. Once inside, there was no sign of the animals nor of any living thing. Prideri walked, bemused, through the deserted hall, from one deserted hall to another, down corridor after corridor. At last, he came to a great courtyard with an elaborate marble fountain in the center. Hanging from a gold chain above it, as though it was used for drinking, was an exquisite golden bowl. Delighted, Prideri reached up and seized the cup. At once he stuck fast to it and couldn't move a muscle in his body. Meanwhile, Manawathan waited outside for Prideri to reappear. He couldn't hear a sound from within the castle nor see any movement. Filled with sorrow and foreboding, he returned to Rhiannon and Kigva and told them what had happened. Well, Rhianna was so furious that he had left her son there and made no attempt to rescue him that she couldn't believe it. "There is strong magic there, Rhianna," he said. "It would not profit you two women if you were left entirely alone." "I'm going to fetch him out," Rhianna said scornfully to her husband. Manawathan tried to dissuade her, but she wouldn't listen. She could think of nothing but that her son was in danger and she must do everything in her power to rescue him. She rushed away from her husband and entered this strange new building. Like Prideri, she wandered through halls and corridors for some time before she came to the courtyard where she found the white marble fountain with Prideri leaning against it, reaching up for that golden cup. He had apparently turned to stone. Knowing at once that it was because Prideri had tried to grasp the golden cup from the Shining Realms without invitation or proper preparation, Rhiannon impatiently rushed forward and tried to take it from his hand, intending to return it to its proper place. But as soon as she touched her son in the cup, she too stuck fast and couldn't move a limb. At that moment, there was a clap of thunder and a thick mist rolled in over the building. And when it lifted, neither the building, nor Rhiannon, nor Prideri were to be seen. Manawathan and Kigva stared in dismay at the place where the building had been. Rhiannon and Prideri found themselves at the center of a jeering crowd and were jostled and pushed until they were brought before the high throne of the ruler of this land. They were greeted coldly by the prince and his ladies, and orders were given for heavy burdens and chains to be put upon them. "Why do you treat us so?" Rhiannon said haughtily. "What harm have we done to you, sir?" "No harm to me," the prince replied, "but to one who is very dear to me." "Who would that be, my lord?" said Rhiannon. "We have no recollection." "That is enough," snapped the prince. "Take them away and let them be used as beasts of burden, for beasts have no recollection or understanding of what they have done either." Well, so for another long period of suffering started for Rhiannon. As they went about their chores, she tried to think who could it be that they had wronged, but she could remember no one. She saw her son occasionally, and every time he noticed her weariness and pallor. Occasionally she saw the prince, and every time he noticed her weariness and pallor, he smiled with satisfaction. Rhiannon observed that every night at a certain time, everyone in the court and around it disappeared. Only the pregnant wife of the prince remained behind. Because the princess was lonely at those times, she would wander out to the yard where Rhiannon and her son were chained for the night, and sometimes she would talk with them. It didn't help Rhiannon to question her, for it soon became clear she had as little idea of why they were being punished as they themselves had. Prideri tried to persuade her to speak to the prince about their release, but Rhiannon could see she was too timid to do that. Having given up trying to find out why they were there, Rhiannon asked the young woman where everyone went at night and why. When they returned, they were so full of noise and mirth. The young woman at first refused to tell them, but one night she seemed particularly lonely and in need of company, and she softened enough towards Rhiannon to tell her that all the others had temporarily transformed themselves into field mice so they could go into the human world to eat up all the wheat belonging to Rhiannon's husband. "Do you not want to go with them?" Rhiannon asked calmly. "They seem to have such great fun." "Oh, no, my husband won't allow me to go." "What? Will not allow you? I would not let my husband rule my life like that. If there was something I really wanted to do, no husband in the world would keep me from doing it." There was no more time for conversation that night because the others had returned. The next night, Rhiannon remarked to Prideri that it looked as though the princess had got her wish after all and gone with the others. Well, she had indeed, and when the others returned, Rhiannon and Prideri noticed at once there was a great deal of agitation and none of the usual celebrating and carousing. They overheard someone say that the princess had been captured and had to be left behind. Rhiannon smiled. "I thought that would happen. She is very pregnant and can't move as fast as the others. That's why her husband didn't want her to go." Prideri looked at his mother with admiration. Even in extremes of adversity, she was quick to think up a plan. Meanwhile, back in Dyfed, Manawathan had at last captured one of the mice that had been devastating his crops every night. It was a nice fat little one, too fat to move as fast as the others. As an example to its companions, he said to Kigva, I'm going to hang this mouse. And he set about gathering the wood to build a gibbet. Surely it's not dignified for a man in your position to go to the trouble of hanging such a small and insignificant creature, Kigva said in surprise. But Manawathan insisted that he would do it. He returned to the mound of Arbar and began to set up the gibbet. He was just working on the construction when a youth appeared and asked what he was doing. Manawathan explained, and the young man said he would not have thought it would bring much honor to a man of Manawathan's standing to take revenge on such a tiny creature in that way. Nevertheless, Manawathan said, I'll do it, for this mouse and its companions have all but made me starve. Before the gibbet was complete, a man accosted Manawathan and offered gold for the mouse. To save Manawathan, he said, from the disgrace he would bring upon himself by doing such a mean and paltry thing. Manawathan gave the same reply he had given before. Now an old man appeared, and after the same conversation and the same reply, Manawathan actually fastened the thong about the mouse's neck. The man then offered Manawathan anything he cared to name for the release of the mouse. And then Manawathan smiled grimly and paused with the noose still around the mouse's neck. Will you give me the release of Rhiannon and Pryderi in exchange for this small mouse? I would, the man replied at once. Will you also remove the enchantment from the land of Dyfed? You shall have anything you ask, only free the mouse, the man cried desperately as he saw the noose still around the tiny neck. Not until you tell me who the mouse is and who you are. And then it all came out. The mouse, of course, was the man's pregnant wife, and he himself was Lewith, the son of Kilcoed, who had avenged the wrong Rhiannon and Powell had done to his best friend Gwal, son of Clud, when he had been tricked into a leather bed and then kicked by Powell's men. Gwal himself could not take revenge because of the assurances he had been forced to give at the time. Ah, said Manawathan, before I release your wife, I want assurances that all is now settled between Gwal and Rhiannon and that no more harm shall come to us because of that old quarrel. I swear, cried Luo. And he reached out his hands for the mouse. Not so quick, Manawathan said. Where is my wife? Then he saw Rhiannon and Pryderi coming towards him. And in the rejoicing, he released the mouse, and they saw no more of Lewith or his wife. And so the rich and fertile land of Dyfed returned to its old form. No one but the four of them had noticed that anything had ever been different, or that any time had passed since they went together to climb the mound of Arbath. And so ends the story of Rhiannon. I need a drink of water. Okay. So anyway, Rhiannon is one of my favorite goddesses, Welsh goddesses. Of course, I love Stevie Nicks' song about her. What could be better? But she's a fairy woman. She's a horse goddess. She is the goddess of life and death. I thought that I would like to read about her and tell her story tonight because, in a way, this is New Year's and we need to renew our land. How are we going to renew it? There's been a spell put on our people and on the world, I think, a spell of death. People in our world are willing to create weapons. They're willing to kill people. They're willing for people to starve. They're willing for people to be homeless. What else but a weird, evil spell would make people feel those things and not want to help? How could we have created such a dark world and yet think we're so good? So, you know, there are many, many things going on in this world. And in this next year, we are going to begin the process of changing all of that. And so I say to you, prepare yourself, prepare yourself. It's time for us to take back our world, to take back our lives. And I hope that some of these ancient stories that I tell and that Lantern tells will help you be inspired to be the hero and the hera or the hera of your own life. So we will end a little early, but with that, I will say good night from the Bard's Grove. Happy New Year, Happy New Year, Lantern. Happy New Year to all of you who support our show, and I hope we'll be able to bring it to you next year. And keep a record of your dreams, for they're your personal stories. And if you have stories you'd like to share, you can always write to us here at the Bard's Grove. And so for one last time this year, merry meet and merry part, and merry meet again. Good night from the Bard's Grove.